Thank you and good afternoon. This humic product presentation is actually many reports on two independent projects, one on irrigated potato in Egypt and the other on corn in Iowa. What do we do here? Just left false click or? Okay. My co-author, Dr. Mosa, recently wrote a book chapter that summarized five studies in which a humic product was applied to irrigated potato in Egypt. The first study was applying the product through drip irrigation systems, surface versus subsurface drip. The second study was increasing water use efficiency by applying the product under deficit irrigation. Third study was interactions of the product with potassium fertilizer. Fourth one was interactions of the product with sulfur fertilizer to control early blight. And the fifth one was benefits of this humic product to soil properties in a sandy soil. Due to time constraints, we'll be lucky to get through these first two. And I will add through email correspondence with Dr. Mosa, he said that in this case, the humic product was, quote unquote, the extract of organic residues that was not separated into humic or fulvic acids. This is a commercially available product. It's made by the Delta Fertilizers plant in Egypt. This first study, applying the product through drip irrigation, this was done at the National Research Center. My understanding is this is very northwestern Egypt during the winter season of 07 to 08. The soil was sandy soil with an alkali pH. The design was split plot. The main plots were the irrigation, comparing surface versus subsurface drip, and the subplots were the humic product applied at 0, 60, and 120 kilograms per hectare with three field replicates. Here are some of the results. The plant measurements, for example, comparing the where's the mouse here? There it is. Comparing the surface drip versus the subsurface drip, you can see that for tuber yield, starch percent, and total soluble solids, there are minor increases in a number of the cases going from surface to subsurface drip. But really, these results are more similar than they are different from each other. So let's average them together and move down here where we can look at the effect of the humic product. Compared to the unamended control, you can see there are some modest increases going up to the intermediate application rate, but at the high application rate of the humic product, there are statistically significant increases in all three cases, or all three parameters. With a tuber yield, that's an increase of 23% with this high application rate of the product. But starch also increased, as did total soluble solids. Here are the micronutrients. All nutrients, NPK, iron, manganese, and zinc. As with the previous table, comparing surface drip versus subsurface drip, there are pretty modest increases going from surface to subsurface drip. So again, let's average them together and move down here at the bottom where we're comparing the humic application rates. And once again, there are minor benefits occurring at this intermediate application rate of 60 kilograms per hectare. But going up to 120, you can see a significant increase in all nutrients. Every single nutrient, there's an increase. And this is concentration per gram of plant material. These kind of data have been found in other studies with humic products. They usually lead, especially industry, but also some researchers, to conclude that somehow these humic products are interacting with the soil, chelating the nutrients, somehow making them more available. That may be the case. I have concerns about that because the dominant controls of these nutrients are very different among the nutrients. Micronutrients, sure, there's chelation, pH effects, and so forth. But N, P, and K, their availability is dominated by very different factors. And I have a hard time believing that any product can increase availability of all of these all at the same time. Instead, I wonder whether the primary mode of action here is the product directly affecting the plant, which makes it more able to scavenge nutrients out of the soil. Let's move on to the second study on irrigated potato in Egypt. This was also done in the northern part of the country, in the delta. In this case, the soil was a clay loam, not a sand soil. This is a case, a study of deficit irrigation. So water was applied at 2,000, 4,000, and 6,000 cubic meters per hectare, all through drip irrigation, with and without potassium humate. Here are the plant biomass data, plant height, number of stems, main stems, dry weight, and leaf area. To make a long story short, one can say that this intermediate water application rate of 4,000 in conjunction with the humate product gave you statistically as good of results as any of these treatments did. They're matched by some of the results at the 6,000 water rate, but of course that comes with greater cost of input. So you're just as well off here with the 4,000 applying this humic product. Here are the tuber measurements, marketable yield. By the way, I've never worked with potatoes, so you will understand these terms better than I do. Dry matter, unmarketable yield, dry matter in tubers, and specific gravity. In this case, the same treatment, the intermediate water rate in conjunction with the humate, gave actually the best results. Statistically, these results are better than any of the other treatments here. Looking here at the marketable yield, these results are statistically higher than anything down here with the higher water input rate. So one could conclude, certainly the researchers did, that this humic product is saving you 2,000 metric cubic meters of water per hectare. And so you're better off at this rate than you are putting more water on. So the water use efficiency was indeed improved under deficit irrigation by applying this product. The effects of the humic product on the nutrients, in this case, N, P, and K, which I'm not showing, were not affected in the plant by the humic product. But in this here, we're showing iron, manganese, and zinc. And they were affected. Once again, it's the same treatment, the 4,000 cubic meter per hectare, the intermediate water rate, in conjunction with the humic substance, gave you as high of results, as high of nutrient concentrations as anything over here did with higher input rate of the water. Well, that's it for the potato. I'll quickly move on to a corn study in Iowa involving a different humic product. The study area here is central Iowa. The soils are very dark, fertile, lots of carbon in them. Not a good area to really be working on a humic product. Let me quickly go through this slide. What we're doing here is we're first taking some of the same measurements we've already seen, crop in-season crop parameters and nutrient uptake grain yield at a few intensively managed sites. But we're also doing a statewide survey of on-farm strips. The previous speaker is the only speaker I've ever heard who talked about doing an on-farm survey before, working in different locations. This perspective is sorely lacking in the humic product literature and even people who are doing this kind of research. By looking at a broader array of landscapes, you can look at the effects of soil type, landscape position, tillage, crop rotation. We know these things can affect the efficacy of other inputs. They probably affect humic products as well. But when most companies do one study in one field and make these grand conclusions from that, you know, good results or bad results, you'll never learn about how these things can play a role. These are our results from 2009, 30 farms that we sampled across Iowa. The product was applied in a strip, and then we came in and took hand samples within that strip and then a few rows over in the unamended area. For these 30 farms here, we took about eight plants, measured their yield components, extrapolated to a per acre basis. What we found, we couldn't get combine grain yield data out of these farmers, so we have to use the hand samples. But out of the 30 farms in 2009, 25 of them showed a numeric increase in grain weight to the humic product. Of those positive results, the average response was about 10 bushels per acre. That is inflated somewhat because we're using hand samples. But still, this was statistically significant. And as was mentioned before, I think Muir mentioned that even if you get an agronomic, a statistically insignificant response, if it pays for itself economically, farmers will do it. What we're learning by doing this broad-scale approach, we're seeing that the product works best in well-drained soils. In poorly drained soils, especially in the wet years of 09 and 010, the product did not have any benefit, and in fact, it may have even been toxic to the plant, to the corn plant. And the product works best when it has a chance to show itself, to strut, and that would be soils that have low to medium levels of carbon, and fields where the farmer is not operating at super high yield levels, 220 bushels per acre and above. We got the same results in 2010, virtually identical, sampling a different set of 30 farms. One in-season observation that we often make is increased root growth. I bet this is analogous biochemically to the potato tuber response to humic products. And this is one field where we have a control treatment and then the humic product applied as a starter fertilizer at pre-emergence and at the third vegetative leaf stage. You can see how the control root system is so much smaller than these other root systems. Well, why is this important? As you know, roots help you take up water and nutrients, especially important in a droughty year like 2011 has been. But something that people aren't as aware of is that roots release huge amounts of root exudates into the soil. By reviewing the literature, you can find studies claiming that the amount of root exudate carbon amounts to anywhere, depending upon your study, from 20 to 80% of the carbon that's in the above-ground biomass. A rough average, maybe about 50%. So if you look at a corn crop or potato crop, see 50% of that above-ground carbon, that's being released into the soil. And when you have a substantially bigger root system like here, might you get more carbon being released into the soil? I don't know. Maybe. Why is this important? Well, all this carbon being released is very labile. It feeds microbial activity, which can in turn improve soil physical properties. All this carbon gives you better cation exchange capacity. You might have better retention of soil or fertilizer nutrients. And, of course, carbon helps keep water in the soil, too. It's my own hypothesis that where companies report improved soil properties with the humic products, in fact, what's happening is that the humic product is not directly interacting with the soil, but instead it's making the plant release a lot more carbon, which in turn then improves the soil properties. It's an unproven hypothesis, but it seems to make a little more sense to me at least than expecting, in this case, we're applying 3 pints of this product per acre. I have a hard time envisioning that amount directly impacting the soil properties. A observation we made going into the middle of the growing season was a transient increase in plant height. On the right here is the applied treatment, and this is the control over here. Number of leaves was the same, so the internodal length was longer, which to my lab director, Jerry Hatfield, suggests that this is a plant hormone-like growth stimulation is what's going on. So then he suggested a series of other measurements that we take, starting first with the date of pollination, which begins the grain filling duration. Grain filling ends in corn with black layer formation when the tips of the kernels die off, which cuts that kernel off from the rest of the plant. In Iowa, the grain filling duration is 53 to 63 days. Where we applied the humic product, we found that the beginning of the grain filling, the pollination, was actually advanced by 3 days in all 4 fields that we worked in. And then in the 2 fields where we took measurements at black layer to determine its date, we found the black layer was delayed by 3 to 7 days. So overall, this grain filling period was extended by a good 10%. To us, again, that suggests a plant some type of a growth stimulation. Nothing to do with nutrients, but probably more of a hormonal-like stimulation. In all 3 years that we've been taking measurements, we have seen longer ears with the product being applied, on average. And we often see thicker cobs as well. This area here is thicker, and the kernels are proportionately bigger kernels. I don't know how I'm doing for time here. These data are the P levels significant for leaf area, another measurement we took to look at a hormone-like growth stimulation. In this field, the product was applied at pre-emergence and also at the 6th vegetative leaf. Now, these are the P levels for how significant was the response of leaf area to the humic product being applied. And we see there are distinct time patterns here where the product is applied pre-emergence At around the 10th vegetative leaf, we start seeing highly significant responses to the leaf area. It continues for a certain amount of leaves, and then it stops again. And we continued measuring through the 21st leaf, and that was the end of the significant levels. Where the product was applied at the 6th vegetative leaf, there was an immediate response statistically, but then there was no response until you got down to about the 13th leaf, so a little bit later and a little more subdued. So these are the types of variables that might affect your results in the field. Crop nutrient uptake. In our 2 years of data so far on plant nutrients, we have seen no effect of this humic product on plant concentration of all nutrients measured. Total uptake per acre, yes, but that's because we have bigger plants, not because the concentration is greater per gram of plant material. And we have a difficult time reconciling these results with claims that humic products directly affect the soil, making the nutrients more available. In general, there's just a lot we don't understand. How much time? Is it time now?
30 seconds.
I was going to skip this graph anyway. It's in general, it's showing that pollination was affected by degree of pollination was affected in drought conditions by the product. We began measuring alfalfa this year. We got a 10% biomass increase in the first cutting. The second cutting was the time of drought in Iowa, no effect, and we'll begin these other measurements next year. In conclusion, in places, you're getting the success stories here. There are lots of failures as well. In places, humic products do benefit plant growth. We need so much more information on when and where these products work and by which product, how they interact with other inputs, fertilizers, and we need a mechanistic understanding. Thank you for your time and patience.
It's my understanding that the next speaker is canceled.
So. Oh. I hope you have some questions.
I got one. So you made some reference in regards to, I think it was soil carbon, as a basis for making soil recommendation for humic acids might be considered, but you didn't provide any parameters for those of us making recommendations. Do you have some parameters that you could...
No, I don't. I mean, we're just at the preliminary stage. I mean, we just started this project. This is our third year now. We haven't done that in an organized manner. There's one area in central Iowa that calls itself the black soil capital of the world. Soil carbon levels there are probably pushing 3%. We have a real difficult time there showing a response of this product. But I would say almost anywhere else, where the carbon level is 2%, even low 2%, and certainly below that, the product does have a chance at proving itself.
So the parameter would be 2% and below, but I would imagine that on the variability that you showed, I can't quite remember the slide, but you had several areas where the responses were positive. So I guess my point is, do you have, on those sites where you saw differences between positive and negative numeric, were there soil organic carbon points that you could place in there?
Yes, good point, and we will do that. We will hopefully write the first paper on these results later this year. That's why we did that on-farm survey. We don't have those data organized yet, but we will do something like that. We're collecting data from those farmers on. We have soil measurements already done, also data on their tillage and yield levels and so forth. I don't expect it to be, well, I don't know. We'll find out. Yeah, but we are planning on doing that, yes. Stay tuned, I guess. This is all pretty new. We just haven't gotten the data far enough, as far along as one would like them to be.
Yeah, when you say that that's soil that have a lot of 3% organic carbon, you didn't have a response in that one. If you compare the grain filling season, by any chance, the grain filling season in that soil, I mean, you did comparison of rows paired detail, but did that soil have a higher grain filling season than the other ones, or was it the same? Or
We didn't compare that. Make that comparison.
Because I mean, I was just wondering, like you calling out a hormonal response, and I was just thinking, how did you went from applying the soil from the root crop to the the hormonal response? I mean, was it something that happened in the roots, or something that went through and went up and then create the hormonal response, or and then it, what's happening with the hormones response in that soil compared to the other one.
Sure.
Any comments?
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Or if it, that soil is holding it, that it doesn't come through and whatever the mechanism.
Well, in contrast to Dr. Syed Bagheri, we don't have a lot of farmers to pick from. In that area, we might have one or two or three farmers who are using this product right now. And we haven't had the labor to systematically set up comparisons like that, but that's, these are both excellent ideas and from both of you, and that's something maybe we should try in the future, I guess, if we can get enough study sites together, we could maybe do a comparison like that. One problem that we have with the farmers is that they typically try it out once or, 1 or 2 years. They'll put it on a portion of their field, and then we can do this comparison. If they like the product, then they want to apply it to the whole field, so we no longer have a comparison. If they don't like the product, they stop altogether. But it's hard to convince them to keep part of the field as a control. So.
What is the cost?
This product is pretty cheap. It's only about $9 per acre. The application rate is only 3 pints per acre. It was designed in it was formulated so that it could be mixed in with pesticide applications. Typically, most farmers are applying this between V3 and the third and sixth vegetative leaves when they typically apply Roundup anyway. And it was designed to be no extra labor cost to be mixed right in with the Roundup. So an average yield response is, our first 2 years of data collection were 09 and 010. In Iowa, those were extremely wet years, very tough to get difficult to get a find a yield response to a product like this. Most fields have plenty of water in them. But we still got an average yield response of probably 6-7, I would say, bushels per acre. With the current corn prices, that's, 3-, 4-, 5-fold return on the cost of the product. So that's why the use of this product is expanding. As Dr. Syed Bagheri said, it's sometimes difficult to show a statistically significant response, but if the farmer can see a 3- or 4-fold return on the cost, they will buy the product. And the sales of this product have been going up over the last 3 years. Sure. I would definitely come down on the side of the other. In the product I'm working with, we're only applying 3 pints per acre. I don't care if that's loaded with nitrogen. That's not going to be enough to make any difference. We did some calculations. The nitrogen actually in this product only amounts to about 1 pound per acre of nitrogen that you're applying to a corn field, which is nothing. So, I don't think it can be the nutrients in the product for that reason. And that's why, when we see these types of responses, we want to think it's not a nutrient response. It's something else in the product. I mean, this is all speculation right now, but I'm a biochemist by training, a soil biochemist, and we're setting up a method to look at the phenolic character of these compounds. Auxin, which is the primary growth hormone, chemically is called a phenoxycarboxylic acid. It's very similar to 2,4-D, which is an auxin as well. Those are both phenoxycarboxylic acids. I talked with a coal expert one time who said he has seen phenoxycarboxylic acids in coal. And if they're in coal, then they're going to be in the lignite and leonardite that these products are made from. Because lignite and leonardite are young coals. They're immature coals. And if coal has these products in them, then a much younger product will have kept them as well. So that's why we're guessing that it's some type of a hormone-like growth stimulation. Auxin primarily impacts the roots. And this product also has a big effect on the roots as well. I'm guessing that in general we're impacting root growth, which then allows more water and nutrients to get into the crop, and that just makes for better growing conditions during the season. There's also a small but growing body of literature, mainly coming from Spain, Italy, and Brazil, where they take organic molecules and add them in a tissue culture setting directly to living cells. And they can these organic molecules stimulate the cell the same way a hormone does. It speeds up an enzyme called ATPase, which sits in the cell membrane, and it uses the ATP to move good nutrients into the cell and bad nutrients out of the cell, which is what a hormone does. That's how a hormone speeds up cell growth.
What do you call a bad nutrient? What do you call a bad nutrient?
What?
Did you say good nutrient and bad nutrient?
Oh, good nutrients. Well,
what do you call a bad nutrient?
Okay, sure. Sure. Well, this ATPase builds up what the molecules do, they speed up the ATPase, which builds up a charge difference across the cell membrane. It kicks protons out of the cell. Then there are other pumps in the membrane that is a nitrate pump and a potassium pump. They use that charge difference to then move nitrate and potassium.
So the hydrogen would be a bad nutrient?
Hydrogen is bad. I think aluminum is also a bad nutrient as well and is moved out by this ATPase. So nitrate and potassium in, hydrogen and aluminum out. So, I mean, that's been shown in the laboratory. The challenge has been showing that's happening in the field where these products are being applied. Everything seems consistent so far, but nobody's proven it yet.
I know, but hydrogen is a nutrient and so does oxygen, but they don't come from the carbon, but they don't come from the soil, so.
Sure. Oh, sure. Yes. Not all soil nutrients. Some nutrients come out of the air and from the water, too. The protons primarily. So.
I don't wonder if there are any research, but do you think the chemicals that are the whole matter is easier to degrade in the agriculture soil will be degradable or
Is there any research on these humic products degrading? I don't know of any research that's been done. A lot of the industry research is very short term. They'll do one study for 1 year and then they move on. That's what they need to do to get their products registered. Researchers have really not been that interested in these products until recently. I guess my perspective is the amount of stable carbon being applied is so small compared to the background organic matter already in the soil that it's a drop in the bucket, really. And that's, for me, is not a real critical issue. It's more the it's more the biochemistry, I guess, that I find interesting.
I've got a philosophical question.
Sure.
Since we have time, do you sell any more
time? Sure.
So how are you feeling working on these soft chemistry, I'll call it soft chemistry materials, as a PhD scientist? Are you ready to take the heat from the other scientific community?
Well, that heat already started the first time I announced in my building that I was working on these products.
You're still stalling.
Sure.
And I don't have a problem with that. I'm with Mir. I cannot think of a potato field in the Pacific Northwest that is not using any humic acid.
Well.
So it breaks the technology and just provides us with direction in the Midwest of where we can make stronger recommendations. Because we can map out fields with the GIS, GPS, but what we're missing in from your data was the soil carbon. That's the parameter that we can key off of.
Mm-hmm.
In a bit of criticism, we didn't have the criteria for making the recommendation based on soil carbon. You probably should have eliminated that from a slide. I agree that soil carbon is there, but I think it was premature in your in the context of your presentation.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, when we write the first paper, we'll have a little more time to talk about that. I mean, I know that this session is on potatoes, so I was trying to minimize the corn work. You know, I think I only had 5 or 6 slides total on corn, but no, I agree. I mean, any statements like that need to be backed up. I took a lot of heat initially by taking on this work, but when you go out and talk in the real world, I guess the attitude I'm reaching is that the researchers are being left behind here. The humic product industry is growing. They've started a trade association. They've banded together to help promote humic products. And you talk to people in that industry, and all of them say their sales are growing. With the high fertilizer prices in late in 2008, that scared a lot of farmers, and they were then willing to try new things. And so in 2009, a lot of them turned to humic products for the first time. And what the industry people are telling me is that things went well enough in 2009 that in 2010, all their return sales are quite good, and they continue to grow. One of them told me all 4 of the major fertilizer companies in North America are in negotiations to buy out humic product companies. They all see a future in this. So I think it has an interesting future. As Muir mentioned, there is snake oil out there, not as much as there used to be, but even a bigger problem today is ignorance. These products are not all the same. They're made from different lignite, different leonardite deposits. They're largely extracted by potassium hydroxide, as he said, but some people use ammonium hydroxide, and they get processed after that differently. Some people neutralize with acid, others don't. Some people mix in micronutrients, they mix in plant hormones. There's all kinds of things out there, and there's too many companies making too many wild claims right now. I think they sincerely believe in their products, but things have not been systematically investigated enough. So I think this is actually a very good situation for researchers to get into. There's a crying need for a systematic investigation, and there does seem to be something happening. These products do seem to be, at least from what I've seen with my product, it does seem to impact the plant growth. At this conference 2 years ago, we had a half-day session on humic products. The companies were the speakers. They stood up and gave their unpublished data. Two of the biggest companies, Lignotech and Helena Chemical, both said the same thing, that they've done either 100 or 200, depending upon the company, different unpublished field studies, and both of them said about 70% of the time there was a numeric positive response of the crop to their product. The crops that they covered were all kinds of things, vegetables, fruit trees, some field crops, potatoes, all kinds of different plants, and they all seem to respond. So there is something happening. I can understand why these humic products have such a bad name, and you're right, maybe rightfully so, but due to previous snake oil problems. But there is something happening here, and our job as scientists is to ferret out the good and distinguish it from the bad.
Thank you so much.